This is Lucas, and I'm back for another ramble. It is, well, I guess it's Thursday today, so we're getting close to the end of the week. That's cool. This is the second attempt at rambling for a little while to keep you company while you work. Thought we would talk about a few things. Had a couple ideas today, and as soon as I start having ideas, I don't know, ideas come with friends, don't they? Because it's like, you know, one idea leads to another, and it just becomes a thing. So I've got a few things I want to talk about today. But first, I want to look at the verse of the day. Let's see what it is. I'm in my YouVersion app here. It says, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ. Boy, we could take that one out of context, couldn't we? That's Galatians 3:28. You know, I think what Paul's getting at in this little segment is how we're supposed to be unified in the church, right? And so, like, he doesn't mean that you're supposed to ignore your gender. He definitely doesn't mean that. He doesn't mean that you're supposed to, you know, pretend like you have no cultural heritage or no, you know, previous religious background. He's just saying that when we are the church, we're one. We're one body. We're Christ's body. And so I know that, man, it's really easy in church to have divisions and to have factions and to have follower groups. And, you know, I wonder if most of the challenges that we've seen with church divisions, I mean, I come from a free grace background for about the last decade or so. Actually more than a little more than a decade, but, you know, and so it gets to feeling like, you know, the factions and the divisions are, you know, just unique to us, but they're not. It's just all through church history, there's been divisions and factions, and it just keeps coming up. No matter how much we talk about it, it just keeps happening. It's our sin nature. And until Christ returns, it's going to be part of what we have to deal with. Doesn't mean we can't improve in our own sphere of influence, but it is just this consistent thing. And I just wonder if all of that that we wrestle with is really just the same programming that Paul was dealing with when he said, some of you follow Apollos, some of you follow Paul. It's just like, man, cut that garbage out. You know, it's just damaging, you know. And so if you have your favorite Bible teacher and you, you know, gripe about other Bible teachers, I don't know. I mean, you know, to some extent, if somebody's teaching something just cuckoo, you know, then yeah, I mean, maybe avoid them, but we just have to be really careful about not turning it into an Apollos and Paul following program. So anyway, hey, that's heavy to start with. That's heavy. Thanks a lot, YouVersion. Start us off with something like that. Yesterday we had like one of the popular verses, but today we had one of the heavy verses. Isn't that funny how, okay, yeah, yesterday we said, you know, some verses are like celebrities, but some verses are like, what's a heavy element? Gold is heavy, but that's not a good... What's that? Boron or, lead's pretty heavy, but that's like toxic. So I don't think I want to do that one. What is a really heavy element? You know what? Let's ask the internet. What is the most heavy element? You know, I want to say it's probably one of the radioactive ones, uranium or, let's see, the most heavy element, heaviest naturally occurring is uranium. Oh my goodness, I guessed it. I guessed it right. Holy cow. Okay. Yeah, okay, uranium, 92 is its atomic number. U-238 is its atomic isotope mass. Yeah, you know, so I don't know. I always have had a fondness for uranium. I remember, so years ago, I don't know if my buddy listens to these podcasts that I grew up with. His name's Justin. Justin was a brilliant guy. And, I remember him reading books that, you know, that like grown-ups would read when he was like five, you know, or something like that. It's just, he was just super brilliant and, was interested in the sciences. He wound up doing, computer science stuff and, you know, works with a big, startup now. And anyway, I remember taking a walk with him years ago when we were kids and I remember where we were on the street when we were having this conversation, probably because it was just so, so unique. We were walking in my neighborhood and he was explaining how they enrich uranium. And I mean, what were like 10 or 8, 10, something like that. He's explaining to me how they take uranium-235 and get it to uranium-238 or whatever. I don't remember what the details are exactly, but I remember just thinking that this is odd. A kid that knows this kind of stuff, but I loved it because I was kind of a sponge. And anybody that knows me, I got a buddy named Mark that always is making jokes about how I constantly ask questions, you know, like if I meet you, I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. I know I ramble on here, but in person, I do tend to ramble a bit, but most of the time I'm more of an interviewer, you know? And so me and Justin we were kind of two peas in a pod because he was full of information and I was full of questions. And so, you know, there we were just, you know, talking about whatever. And everything he said would lead to another question. Like, why is it U-238 or whatever? And so I've always enjoyed having friends that have unique, knowledge bases that are just outside of mine. Like this summer, I think I mentioned yesterday that we went to see our friends, in Virginia. Matt is a farmer. And so I almost said his last name, but then I thought maybe I shouldn't say last names on here. So Matt, my farmer friend, and, we learned a bunch. I mean, I really think Matt could be like an agriculture professor. He's really a teacher. As far as I know, he's a great farmer too, but I don't know how to judge that, but I can judge teaching and he's a really great teacher. We rode around the farm and he taught me about lots of different things and showed me how to do a lot of stuff. We learned to process chickens, which is like how you take the chicken from a living squawking animal to, you know, chicken tenders. And so that was really interesting, but there is another buddy with a really unique, skill set. I met a new friend on a recent, hiking trip that we did with our ministry. His name is, Ty, and Ty, purchases distressed properties in like in a pretty big area, you know, so he watches, various, like sites, like websites and looks for foreclosed stuff, or bank repos, I think, you know, just anything like that. And then he will, you know, get them cleaned up and then he'll often resell them and, not often. I think that is always the goal is to resell them. And he had a really great, you know, knowledge base that was all new to me. And so I spent some time asking him questions. And one of the things I learned is that in his area, he's from Florida, in his area, when you're looking at distressed properties, one of the things that you have to check is if it's in a wetland. And that's totally, I mean, I'm in East Texas and so I don't think we have wetlands. We have land and we have wetness. But I don't think we have wetlands. I don't know exactly, but in Florida, that's a really big deal. And so like, that's just a little tidbit I picked up. If I ever was looking at property in Florida, I guess I'd need to know that. And there's probably other places that a wetland is important to know too. So, cause apparently If you buy a property that's in a wetland, there's lots of restrictions that come along with it. And so, it can block you from being able to improve it the way you need to make a profit. And so anyway, so he had these kind of data points that he follows when he's looking at properties. And he was kind of, you know, and so I'm just asking questions, not necessarily because I'm ever going to do that, but for some reason, when someone has some interesting knowledge base, I just can hardly help but ask, you know, ask lots of questions. Another one came up just the other day. Oh, I met a guy who was a aircraft mechanic, and we got into, and so I started asking questions about aircraft. I don't know much about aircraft, but I you know, I hear little sniblets. There's a made up word. I hear little sniblets, and it's interesting to me, you know, so I started asking him about the, I think he worked on the F-15. And I picked up a few terms. I sort of learned that if you say platform, actually, I think I got this from a different aircraft guy, but if you say platform, my understanding of that is like the F-15 is a platform, meaning that, there's lots of things that you can change within it as time goes by and technology increases, but the F-15 is kind of this standardized platform across the industry, the F-16, the F-22 Raptor, whatever. I don't know. I don't know aircraft very well. But anyway, started asking him, you know, different things about aircraft. And I had heard at some point that when they came out with the F-22 Raptor, I think that's the Raptor, that there was all kinds of problems with it, you know, and it was a big news story. And usually the story goes something like this. They spent $50 billion and, you know, it has these glitches. And, you know, so at some point I started to wonder, well, wouldn't every new thing that you make have some glitches you got to work out? And if you spend a lot of money, you're just going to be doing that, working it out in front of, you know, the taxpayers. And I think it's probably similar to what NASA had to go through. You know, they're getting all this money to try to get to the moon, and any little foible is, you know, it's public record. So anyway, as I asked him about that, he said, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, you know, these platforms, they, you know, when they're new, there's a lot to work out, but he said the F-22 is incredible. He said that thing is amazing. This kind of surprised me. He said its kill record is, I think he said undefeated. I could be wrong about that, but he said, like, you know, they mark down the kills it has, and has one ever been shot down? He said one's not been shot down, and that could just be because it's not as old. He said one hasn't been shot down, but it's gotten quite a few kills. And he gave a number. I think he said 75 or something like that. And I was like, wait a minute, 75 kills? Are you saying that there's been that many conflicts where F-22s have, cause it hadn't been out that long, you know? And it's like, yeah, they're out shooting stuff down. So it's like, man, I didn't know that. I mean, like, you know, I think of it like, if I didn't hear about it in the news, then it didn't happen. But apparently this stuff's happening, you know, stuff's out there. So anyway, I just, I really love meeting folks that have a different knowledge set, and it could be anything. Like, if I meet an air conditioner guy, it's just funny. If I meet an air conditioner guy, I've usually got a handful of questions that I don't know. I'm just kind of interested in that technology. If I meet a plumber, if I meet I got a buddy who runs a sawmill named Billy, and I've enjoyed learning stuff from him because, I mean, you know, there's so many things that go into every career that you pick up over time. And I don't know. I love the idea of being able to, you just can't do it all, you know, and you can't know it all. Even AI, you know, it doesn't know it all. It knows a lot. It doesn't know anything in the sense of the word that we would use of a human, but it's got access to a lot of information. But there's things that aren't on the internet, and, you know, AIs are just built on the, you know, what's on the internet. Speaking of AI, I was thinking recently about making a list of things that AI won't change. Coffee break here. Here we go. When I do a coffee break, it gives you a chance to get your thoughts together and decide what you're going to say. And then you remember, nope, Lucas is just rambling. There's no place for you to speak. But I promise you, if we meet in person, like what I'm doing right now feels a little wrong because it feels like I'm not leaving space for you to talk, you know, because if I did this in person, you would be so annoyed. At least I'm annoyed when people just talk and don't give me a chance to ask them the next question or whatever. But anyway, I was about to say something about AI. Oh yeah, AI. So thinking about making a list of the things that AI won't change, because there are some things that AI just isn't going to change. It changes. It can change basically. Oh, there's a child here. Hey, let's listen. Oh, somebody is throwing a fit. Either that or a small spider monkey. Let's see if it sounds like a mama or a baby. It's right outside my office door. Huh. I wonder what's going on there. Every once in a while I hear a large dog barking, and I think it's a German Shepherd. Somebody in the building has a German Shepherd, and they will bring it to work sometimes. Or bring him to work. I don't know if you can say him. So AI, things that AI won't change. They have the third try here. One of the things that occurred to me that AI, I mean, there's a number of things that it won't change. But one of the things that I just don't think AI is going to change anytime soon is person-to-person communication face-to-face. Like, it might change it in a negative way in that, like, we have less experience with it, you know? But I was thinking, I'm coming from a church background, ministry background. Let's just use an example of, like, people say, oh, you know, like, AI can write the pastor's sermon now, but if he's still delivering the sermon, he's still got to be good at that. And AI isn't going to make him good at that. It can give him kind of polished words, you know, but if he can't stand in front of the crowd and deliver, then the AI really hasn't helped him much, you know? And so that opens up a whole list of things that I think you don't have to be afraid that AI is going to ruin everything or change everything, because there's a lot of, like, I don't know, personal interactions that, that AI just isn't touching. And I'm sorry, I'm having trouble because I'm really distracted by the sounds that are outside my door. Okay, I think they're subsiding. I don't know what's going on out there. Maybe they're starting a daycare. Wouldn't that be neat? Right next door, daycare, screaming all day long. And so that led me to think about just kind of, in general, what AI might wind up doing. And I'm talking mostly about the text, generative text models. What they might actually do is free us up from tasks that we were never great at anyway, which is like large data computation that gets translated into language. That's always been kind of tough for people, and it's been pretty laborious. So let's say that AI takes those kind of tasks away from us. What would we do? Well, I think what we would do, I hope, is we would actually just spend more time with each other. We would be face to face more. We would, you know, if AI can handle all of the tasks that we don't really want to do, then what I hope is we would enhance our lives by, being less isolated, you know. And I mean, I think you think about jobs over the decades and the jobs that have gone away because of new technologies. And it's always scary when that's coming, you know, when that's headed toward us. It's always scary because it's like, you know, I've learned this skill set. I've learned this, you know, this ability to do this, you know, these tasks. And now it's going to be taken away and I don't know what I'll do. But I think, like, if you look backwards, it's easier to say, I think about like, letterpress. We had a big, you know, 100-year-old, letterpress with the lead type and everything for a while. It was like 1,000 pounds. It's huge and took up a big part of our garage, but we thought it was kind of a novelty sort of a thing. It was kind of neat. And so we had it for a while, and doing it is kind of fun if you don't have to do it and you just want to show your friends, like, here's how typesetting worked and here's how you put the ink on the platen and here's how you roll the whatever. You know, that can be kind of fun. But if you had to do it as a job every day, you could find meaning in it. But now it's like, why, it feels like, why would anybody want to do that? You know, why would anybody want to spend their days doing that? I mean, it's, you know, it's hard work. And so it's easier once there's no one that has been trained to do it to say that. But when there's still people that are like mid-career, you know, they got trained to do a certain thing, it's harder for them to assess, like, yeah, why would anybody want to do that? And I wonder about like some of the jobs that are just kind of dirty, kind of grimy, kind of difficult. Like I think I've got friends that are in the oil field and they talk about in Texas, especially like how incredibly hot it is and how draining it is and how difficult. And like, if at some point we have AI robots that go and work in the oil field, sure, there are guys that will feel threatened because their livelihood is threatened. But in 50 years when no, you know, maybe 75 years when nobody has been trained to do that anymore and, you know, we've moved on, I don't think it's going to be hard to say, yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious nobody actually wants to do that now. They want to do a different kind of thing, you know, and I don't know what all those things would be, but I just don't think there is a limit to the kind of meaningful, work we can do for each other. And I think, I wonder sometimes if maybe that's what's going on. If you think, you know, like from a spiritual perspective, I kind of wonder if maybe in the last 150 years, that might be what God is allowing with the advance of technology, is to give us the opportunity to suddenly have a lot more leisure time. And we do. I mean, right now, the amount of leisure time we have, I would say, actually, I don't know, it's not all leisure, but the amount of non-labor time we have is through the roof compared to where we were 100 years ago. And so, so what do we do with that? You know, and I think from a creator's perspective, looking down on us, it's like, I want to give you the opportunity to do something great. I want to give you more time. I want to allow, I mean, think about all the appliances that have, allowed whoever the domestic manager in your house, whether it's a lot of times it's a wife, sometimes it's a husband, whoever that domestic manager of the house is, they used to have to spend an incredible amount of time in all of the daily household tasks. But appliances have made that, I mean, have changed that, you know, that it's just different. And there's a lot more time. And I imagine our creator looking down on us and saying, like, I'm giving you this gift of efficiency, this gift of, robotic dishwashers. You know, we have a dishwashing machine and a clothes washing machine and an air conditioner in our house. And all of those, we say, are we scared of robots? Those are all robots. They don't look like people. They're not humanoid robots, but they're all robots that have been doing work for us for years. And nobody
it seems to me nobody looks at the dishwasher and says, oh man, it's stolen a bunch of people's jobs. They used to be able to wash dishes. I mean, it's like, yeah, nobody's thinking that way now because they're not mid-career. We've had dishwashers for a long time. And so what has happened to all the people that would have been washing dishes? Well, hopefully they've gone and they found more meaningful work. And when you're comparing meaningful work against work that just is a drudge, usually meaningful work is work that's connected to other people, that has some semblance of like serving other people or bringing a value or benefit to their lives, you know? And so I think of this place where we are and our creator looking down at us and just like, you know, I'm allowing these technologies so that you'll have more time so that you can spend it well. And spending it well would be like, you know, being together more. And, you know, I was just thinking yesterday about like the amount of time that I can spend with my kids compared to probably how it was with dads, you know, a century ago, you know, it's just everybody was living close to what we would consider the poverty line and they had to work a lot to just, you know, get the basics. And things have gotten cheaper because of mechanization, robotics, assembly line type stuff. Things have gotten so much cheaper and they're going to continue to get cheaper, I think. I mean, what I imagine will happen is humanoid robots are going to begin to be able to take over certain manufacturing jobs and probably have already, well, they already have started. And I know that sounds scary because it's like, well, there's a lot of people working manufacturing, but listen to what I'm saying. What it does is that frees those people up to do something different. And also, and you say, well, but if they can't work, then they won't have money to buy the things, you know, and then they'll be destitute. But listen to, I mean, think about it as a whole scenery. What happens when you mechanize manufacturing is whatever's coming out of the back end of that factory becomes cheaper. It becomes cheaper to make. Now, that doesn't mean that they automatically drop the prices, but competition, hopefully, you know, this is the theory, competition among different providers of goods hopefully will drive those prices down. And so then people who used to have to work, you know, 70 hours a week, 60 hours a week, it just decreases 50 hours a week, 40 hours a week, might get down to where because things are cheaper, it can, you know, it will decrease the amount they have to work. And I know here's what you're thinking probably and what most people are probably thinking is like, no, what I'm seeing is everything's getting more expensive. But I think now I'm not an economist, by the way. This is just a ramble. And if so look, I really could be totally wrong on all this stuff, but this is just kind of where I land on it right now. So you look at it and you say like, well, things are getting more expensive, but that's the short run look. You know, that's like the things are getting more expensive if you compare the dollar amount, but that has to do with inflation. But if you look at the price, the cost of producing things over the last 50 years, it is absolutely cheaper to produce a whole host of things. And those prices for those things has really decreased. So imagine like, I feel like you see it in toys. Okay. Cause I mean, that's a very competitive market. And so 100 years ago, well, let's say 200 years ago, a toy basically had to be handmade, which means that a person had to put their time into it and they had to be a craftsman, which means, you know, they had to have a pretty high skill set. It might be carved out of wood. The materials were more expensive because, you know, they didn't have the kind of plastics and whatnot. And so you might say like, a toy, a decent toy, like a middle of the market toy 200 years ago might have been a penny. And today it might be 10 bucks, but I'm just picking numbers here. But what a penny would buy back then was actually a whole lot more, right? So, and this is just the idea of inflation. You guys are probably way more advanced than me on economics, but this is just the way I'm, you know, kind of like simply looking at it. And so that toy 200 years ago is actually a lot more expensive if you think about buying power, you know. So today, a $10 toy or a $5 toy or a $1 toy, maybe the way to do it is to say 200 years ago, the toy might have been $1 and today it's might be $1, but think about all the inflation that has happened between then and now. And that means that today's toy that you can get for a dollar you get the idea. Anyway, I'm not an economist. I could be wrong about all this stuff. This is my impression of the world though. But the point was that when people are afraid of losing work, losing jobs, I think the thing to remember is that mechanizing and putting robots in tasks means that we can get things cheaper and we can get labor. I saw an estimate a while back that, you know, labor right now, there's a minimum wage, but there's not going to be a minimum wage on robots. And so it may not be long before you can get labor out of a humanoid robot with a generally good skill set for like a penny an hour or something, like for not much above the electricity it takes to run the thing. And so when we get to that point, things will be able to be manufactured much cheaper. And that means that the person who is working less has a lot higher buying power because things are cheaper. And that'll happen in the food industry. It'll happen in the manufacturing industry. It'll happen eventually in all the labor industries where there are, you know, tasks that humans do. They can be replaced with humanoids. And so if you're stuck in the old way of thinking and you're thinking about, well, but that means everybody loses their jobs, I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think it'd be a lot more positive to say what those people who have lost their jobs have just gained. They have gained a higher buying power and they have gained their time. And what are they going to do with their time? Well, maybe they're going to make a rambling podcast like me. Although actually I'm actually at work right now. This is part of our ministry. It's kind of amazing that this is part of our ministry with me rambling, but it is. But people can then create jobs that serve other people. And this is my spiritualized theory of all this, that if I were to say, why would God allow all of these new technologies? I think it's because, I hope, and I think it's because, I think God sees that there is a lot more meaning that people can get out of life if they can be in community with each other, serving each other, you know. And so I can imagine a world where robots do lots of the tasks that and people do the meaningful jobs. You know, the jobs that have to do with other people. I think it could be a beautiful kind of world. Now, could it become a dystopian nightmare? Yeah. And that's probably going to happen too. But people, have been created by God to look at our world and say, what do we need to change? What do we need to fix? Now we know that, you know, in the time before Christ comes back, it's going to become a mess. But in the intervening time, you know, before then, before the tribulation and, you know, all of that, I think things can continue to improve to some extent, you know, within limits. And, you know, war plays a big part of that. If we don't have another world war, for instance, I think generally things can become a little bit better over time. If we descend into war, well, things can get worse, you know? So when people say, are things getting generally better or generally worse? I'm like, well, we're in an upswing right now, I think, in some areas, but we're in a downswing in other areas. But like in quality of life, I think we're in like an 80 to 100 year upswing. You know, it's just amazing. You know, you see the news and they make it sound like everything's falling apart, but then I'm looking around like, well, goodness, it's pretty good. Like things are nice, you know, and like there just seems to be stability where we are anyway. And it's amazing. It's fantastic. You know, like with the political cycle, you know, you know, a new person gets elected and one end of the political, commentary spectrum is hollering and saying, this is the worst thing ever. You know, everything's falling apart, but I'm looking like I still have a car. I still have, you know, a house. We still have food on the table. I'm like, man, things seem great. And then someone from the other party gets elected and, you know, their opponents start screaming on the news. And I'm like, but I still have a car. I still have food on the table. I still have a house. You know, it's just like, man, I think we need some perspective. We're being sold this idea that everything is terrible and everything is falling apart. And in reality, for me, my experience is we have a pretty incredible level of stability. Now, by the way, I separate from that moral issues. I think we do need to pay attention to moral issues. And some people say, well, you know, that's political. But I'm just like, no, morality is morality. And it's always been the purview of of the Bible and of the church. And so I'd say it's our responsibility as individuals, as churches, as spiritual leaders to focus on morality and continue to give good, sound advice on morality. But when we're just talking about like economics and politics, I'm just like, man, I don't know. Things have been stable for me. You know, so I know that probably will like bug some folks that I say that, but this is just a ramble. Again, I could be wrong. I could always be wrong, but let's just remember, so could you. So, I mean, we could just be wrong. Can you admit that? It's really a pretty important thing to be able to admit. Like, yeah, I could be wrong. And then so I like this idea of like, you know, here's my opinion, but I always like to put bookends on it and say, but I don't know. I could be wrong. It's okay. I'll be flexible. I like being flexible. I think it's a lot better. Coffee break there. So that's quite a ramble. Hopefully I haven't offended you, my 1 to 2 listeners. But yeah, I don't know. I'm just like, I think things are pretty amazing. You know, I'm a little bit of a student of history, not a buff. I don't even know what that means. I'm not a buff. I'm not an aficionado, but I am a bit of a student of history, and things are better than they used to be. You know, I mean, any pick a century, you know, I was having a conversation with a guy the other day, and he wanted to talk about eschatology, which is like, you know, study of the end times. He was really against the idea that things are getting better, you know. And that's a pretty standard thing that you see in eschatology discussions. Those who think that there's not going to be a literal kingdom, you know, a lot of times, I said that wrong. Those that think there won't be a millennial kingdom, they often think that things will just keep getting better until Jesus returns. Those that think there will be a literal kingdom, these are kind of broad brushstrokes. It's a little bit more common to hear them say that things will continue to get worse until the end, you know. And so he was going on about that and was saying, you know, things are going to get worse and worse and worse until the end. And I was like, okay, I understand what you're saying, but like I have indoor plumbing And he was like, well, yeah, okay, so some things have gotten better. And I'm like, yeah, and we have air conditioning too, you know, and so it's like things have gotten a lot better in certain ways. what I do wonder about is, have things generally gotten better in a moral, in the area of morality? You know, I hear people say like, you know, it's worse than it's ever been in the history of the world, you know, because we allow certain, you know, certain moral issues in our country. But I don't know about that. I mean, in studying history, a lot of times history is a little bit polished and we kind of leave out some of the more horrifying things. But if you go and kind of like dig into what were some of the practices that compare to some of the hot button issues today, like for instance, abortion. You know, so we have medical abortion today, but there was a really brutal form of that in the ancient world, which is kind of hard to even talk about. In the ancient world, their form of abortion, I'm thinking in the Roman era, and I'm not an expert on all eras, you know, I'm not an expert on any era, but in the Roman era, they had a form of it and it was called exposure. And what they would do, this is hard to even say because I got kids, you know, what they would do is they would take their babies, unwanted babies or babies they couldn't care for, and they'd take them outside the city and they would just leave them there. They just expose them to the elements and the baby would die, you know, and so you'd find dead babies around, you know, near roads and stuff like that. That seems really brutal to me. I mean, I don't know. And so like when we say, you know, abortion today is so much worse, I'm like, good grief, I don't know. I don't know. That was terrible. And honestly, the early church, the Christians, it was one of the ways that they showed that they were different is they would find these exposed babies and they would take them home and raise them. If they weren't dead, I guess they maybe would bury them if they found them otherwise, but they would take them home and they would raise them as their own. And man, that made a difference. People noticed that. They were like, wow, these Christians are different, you know? So I don't know. And if you compare the various, you know, I'll call it moral political, like moral political issues, they all have, you know, they all have comparisons to that. You know, another form that I associate with ancient abortion was sacrificing babies to idols. Like Molech, which was an ancient Near East god, they would, God, this is terrible. It's another one that's hard, kind of hard to talk about, but they had this bronze statue of Molech. See, I get them confused. Was it Molech or was it like Baal of Peor? I don't know, but I think it was Molech that they would, this bronze statue and he has his hands out in front of him and they had the fire underneath his hands, you know, his two hands are sticking out and they would lay the baby on those hands and burn him. And I'm not sure if they'd burn him alive or burn him dead, but I mean, if they would kill them first, and this is horrible, but I don't know if they would kill them first but my point is the ancient world was insanely brutal. And I mean, people would watch this, you know, so like today's abortion kind of goes on behind closed doors and there's privacy and, you know, people have the right to like keep it quiet and they don't necessarily want to talk about it. But in the ancient world, this was done out in front of people, you know, this was on display, you know, and, you know, obviously one of the big things that the Bible was trying to get the children of Israel to stop doing was sacrificing their kids to Molech. You know, that was a big deal. And so that set Israel apart is like, you know, if you were in any of these countries around them, people are burning their babies, and you go to Israel, and now they had times of disobedience where they did terrible things, but generally it's like you go to Israel and it's different. It was a different place. It was like they didn't do that. At least they weren't supposed to. And so then when we compare our society today, I'm like, yes, we have work to do. Like to me, abortion's wrong. I mean, we don't, you know, but to take abortion and say things are worse than they've ever been, I'm like, no, it's just some things seem like they don't ever completely go away. You know, the different kinds of, you know, sexual things, sexual orientation, and, you know, in the ancient world, they had some really brutal versions of that, which I just am not going to talk about. I don't want to talk about it, but they didn't have the legal protections for minors, you know, back in the ancient world. And so some terrible stuff. So it's hard for me to look at society today and say it's way worse than it's ever been. But I could look at society today and say it can get way worse. You know, I mean, there's still sin in the world, but here's the thing. And I think this shows the power of the church in history is that what do we attribute the change to? If things have improved, like for the people that say the world is just going to get worse and worse and worse until Jesus comes back, I'm like, well, then where is the church? Are they just utterly failing? And I think that is the vision, is that the church is just utterly failing. But that's not my vision. My vision is that the church has changed the world. The church has changed the world in such incredible ways that now we have created a society where there are points in modern history, in recent history, where large numbers of people agreed that these things, that we shouldn't do these things, but they might would allow it just because we're trying to allow freedoms or something like that. But like large numbers of people are like, no, we shouldn't do that. That's not, these things aren't good. You know, so something has changed. Now, there's a difference between like everybody does it and not many people do it, but they allow it. There's a difference between those two things. And I think we're closer to the latter than the former, but I think the ancient world was closer to the former. You know, it was like these accepted things. And so in modern society, it seems to me like 2,000 years of the church's influence has changed where our baseline for morality is. Now that baseline could move. I'm admitting it could move. War does that. You know, famine does that, things like that. But like, it's like, yeah, it could move, but it has moved in an improvement direction, in my opinion. Now, I'm not trying to make a theological argument for any eschatology here. I'm just saying, if I'm looking at history, the church has had a huge effect. The church has had a huge effect on worldwide morality, and places where the church has had less effect or has not had as much of effect for a long time, you know, like say 500 years, 1,000 years, their morality is different. It's a different expectation on the morals of people. And so there are places in the world where we don't see that improvement, but we happen to be living in a place that has been hugely, I assume most of you guys are listening from the United States or Canada. We're living in a place where society has hugely been impacted by the church. Now, do we still have some huge challenges? Yes, we obviously do. And it's sad because I feel like we've gotten to a point where we had made some moral improvements, and I think we're seeing slippage, you know, I think we're seeing moral slip, But it's not clear to me whether that moral slip is with the majority or with, if it's with like a fringe, you know, numbers. It's hard for me to say. I don't know. Cause you might say the X number of people engaged in such and such behavior, but I don't know how many people are there that didn't, you know, like if there's 300, 400, I don't know how many are in the United States. There's 300 million in the United States. Then I think it's more useful to understand what the fraction of people that didn't do said thing is than, you know, just this massive number. Now, should we be in a world where abortion, for instance, is just like not a thing? Yeah, of course. And it's coming, you know, Jesus is coming. But he hasn't returned yet. And I think he's giving us this opportunity to do what we can in the time that we have. And one of the greatest ways, I think, to share the gospel and to have an effect on people is to improve the world, you know, the world around us as we talk about Jesus. Now, if you just improve the world and don't talk about Jesus, I don't think you're doing the work. If you just talk about Jesus and don't improve the world, I don't think you're doing the work. I think we need a balance of both, you know, and think in that approach, the church really shines when it's working, when it's doing what it's supposed to, and it changes society. And so now we have these pockets of like atheists and agnostics who will claim morality. They'll say, well, I'm a good person. I'm a moral person, but what they don't seem to be accounting for is the fact that they are living in a society that has morality that has grown out of the church, you know, that's grown out of Western society that's deeply impacted by the church. And that doesn't mean that every single individual is a believer, but when you have a large number of believers in a particular area and they are seeking to live in a certain way, that has an effect on even the unbelievers. And so when an agnostic or an atheist says, well, I'm a good person, I think the question is, well, have you been living around Christians at all? Have you been around religious people? Have you been, you know, in contact with, you know, those from a Judeo-Christian, you know, heritage? Because if you have, you can't fully say that you're good because you're an atheist, or you're good because you're an agnostic, or you're just good because you're innately good. You can't prove, unless you have a control group, that you have actually grown that good out of yourself, or if it's grown because of the society that you're in that has been deeply affected by the church. So anyway, here's maybe a bottom line though, is it is really easy to feel overwhelmed and to feel, you know, these complex feelings of like everything's falling apart. But in a church, we're going through Daniel, and he has this really great line in Daniel 2. It's after God has given him the understanding of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And he says a number of things, but one of the things he says is that, God, you are in charge of changing the seasons, and you make kings rise and fall. You know, and so it's like those two things are really important. I mean, for one, like climate change, people are stressed about climate change on the one side, and they're stressed about people pressuring them, about climate change on the other side. And so it's like climate change is a stressor one way or another. If you're deeply conservative, the stress is coming from those who are probably, you know, debating. If you're on the other side of the aisle, it's that you're afraid the world is going to die, you know, but it's like the Bible says there that God is in charge of the seasons. God is in charge of the weather. And it's interesting to me that we will blame each other for the weather. And it just, and I'm not saying the climate isn't changing. It might be, it might not be. I don't know. But for me to blame my neighbor because the climate is changing is incredibly unproductive. It's incredibly unproductive, because at a person-to-person level, we you know, it just like, that's not what we're called to do. I don't think we're called to try to control each other, blaming each other for the weather. And the Bible says a couple of times, it mentions that in Daniel, but then also in Genesis, it talks about, that as long as they're, again, like right after the flood, it talks about how God will, I should just look up that verse. It's a really great verse for people that are feeling stressed about climate change. Let's see. Well, you get to hear how I find verses that I can't quite remember. I'm pretty sure it's Genesis 9. What is that verse in? About God being in charge the seasons. Let's see how far off I got. Ah, yeah. Oh man, this is so good. Yeah, this is really good. I mean, this should be part of any climate change discussion if both people are believers. If you're talking to somebody that's not a believer about climate change, then I don't know, this maybe wouldn't be effective, but check this out. This is in verse 22. So you can put this in your pocket for climate change debates. No, that's not 22. I'm sorry, it's not 22, because that's about Shem and Japheth. Okay, whoever sheds human blood. Well, goodness, where is it? Okay, here it is. I'm sorry, it's 8:22. I think it was in 9. Anyway, 8:22. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will never cease. Now that doesn't say every season will be great, but by and large, generally speaking, broad brush strokes, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. So it's saying that we're going to have cold and we're going to have heat. We're going to have summer and we're going to have winter. We're going to have seed time and harvest. The seasons will continue. They will not cease as long as the earth endures. And so to me, if you are feeling stressed about climate change and you're a believer, think about that. I mean, God has made that as a promise. This is part of the Noah promise. You know, he's like, I'm not going to shut down the seasons. I'm not going to shut down your ability to grow food. If the earth is here, you're still going to be able to do this. And so, you know, with climate change, it's like we are dealing with a potential future challenge. But yet again, I'll go back to the table. Is there food on the table? And right now, largely due to mechanization, yet again, we are able to feed 8+ billion people. 8 billion people. The agricultural methods of the ancient world just wouldn't have been able to do that. We are able to do that because we've mechanized, and we actually need a lot less arable land than we used to because of efficiencies. And of course, I'm no expert in agriculture, but just look at the numbers of the amount of people we're feeding. You know, and so it makes sense to me that as the population grows, that God might make adjustments in how the earth is operating so that we can expand to do 9 billion or 10 billion or 50 billion, who knows? But wouldn't it make sense that there would need to be some adjustments made? And would we understand those adjustments as they're happening? I just would say no. I don't think we would understand them. I talked to a meteorologist a while back and asked her about predicting the weather. And I was like, you know, is it reasonable to think that we can predict the outcome of climate change? She's like, no, we can't. We struggle to predict the weather 2 weeks out. You know, it's like it becomes pretty inaccurate farther than that, you know? And so the idea of saying that we know exactly what's going to happen, like say it is getting warmer, say it is changing, the idea that we're able to know exactly what those effects are is kind of difficult. Now, again, not an expert. I could be totally wrong. In fact, I know I'm got to be wrong on something I said because I've been talking for an hour. But my point is just, this is the part I know, is that God said he made us a promise that we're going to continue to be able to grow food. Now that doesn't mean that every inch of the earth is a good place to grow food, but we're going to continue to be able to do that. We're going to continue to have seasons. He's in charge of that. And so in that, I don't see any option for pointing the finger at each other and saying, you have to, you have to feel belittled because you're putting out too much carbon or whatever. Now this is within limits. I mean, if like we're blacking the town out with coal soot, yeah, we probably should make an adjustment. But what I feel like is that we have created a mechanism to blame each other for the weather. It seems like such a control mechanism. It seems like something we're doing so that we can, gain control over each other. And I just want us to remember God said he's in charge of the weather. You know, that God, it's God's job to decide what goes on in the weather. And I just happen to come from a place of faith. If it so happens that we are burning up the fossil fuels that he gave us, a little too quickly, he will help us make, he will adjust for that because it's his job. Weather is God's department, you know, and maybe that could be our statement if it ever comes up. It's look, the weather is God's department. And if we are stewarding poorly, it seems that he's promised to make adjustments for that because he's promised that we're going to continue. Now we can hurt the immediate environment we're in. You know, if we dumped toxic waste all in our neighborhoods. I mean, of course, that would be a huge problem. We need to respect, you know, the area we're in. But I just think like weather is God's problem, you know, and every time I take an airplane somewhere and I look down at the world, I'm like, good grief, we're small. We're just so little here, you know? So it's all in God's hands. We do need to be responsible on a personal level. But I think we need to stop blaming each other for the weather. I think, you know, we just remember that's one of the departments of heaven, not of earth. And if someday we can control the weather, then wow, you know, amazing, but we're a long way away from that. So I think that's probably enough rambling. I'm at an hour and 2 minutes. Hopefully I've kept you company. Hopefully I haven't offended you. But if I have and you've called me on it, probably what I'd say is, well, I could be wrong. I don't know. So anyway, thanks for listening, you guys. And I'll probably be back sometime soon. We'll see you later.